Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, June 17th. I'm Ray Graff, in for Alan Chartok. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital, investing in the health care of the Saratoga community, announcing the second linear accelerator at its Radiation Oncology Center, Saratoga Hospital, an affiliate of Albany Med. Joining us for Medical Monday today, Dr. Paul Glavinsky of St. Peter's Sleep Center. If you have trouble falling or staying asleep, Dr. Glavinsky is just the person to help you out. If you have a question, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Paul Glavinsky and your sleep questions coming up on Vox Pop right after this news. Hi, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's a Medical Monday today, and Dr. Paul Glavinsky, Clinical Director of St. Peter's Sleep Center in Albany, New York, is joining us. Dr. Glavinsky is a clinical psychologist who has been working in the field of sleep disorders for more than 30 years. He's a fellow of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine and has co-authored two books, the most recent of which is You Are Getting Sleepy, as well as dozens of articles. His specialty is in behavioral sleep medicine with a focus on the treatment of insomnia and circadian rhythm disorders. He also maintains a practice in New York City. If you want to be a part of the conversation today, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551, or if you wish, you can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop or email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number, and after all, it's a call-in program, 800-348-2551. Dr. Paul Glavinsky, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Before we get started with the calls, tell me, what is a circadian rhythm disorder?
It actually will lead into the first question I see up there. So we have a clock in our hypothalamus, in our brain, the times when we can best sleep and when we feel most awake.
Yeah.
And this clock also times everything else in the body. They all take their cue from it. So when the timing is off, different functions are also off. For example, if your clock is not pointing to sleep in terms of temperature or hormone release, and you try to go to sleep, even if you think it's bedtime, you won't go to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a circadian rhythm disorder.
What about people who work at night?
That's right. Then you can create a circadian rhythm disorder. That's a shift work type.
Yeah.
And there are adaptations that work somewhat. It's always a challenge depending on the shift, on how to sleep well when you're either second shift or overnight shift.
Humans, I assume, have been trained over thousands of years to sleep when it's dark and be awake when it's light?
They have. There was a wonderful study done just a couple of years ago. Someone had access to the last indigenous tribes. One didn't even have huts and very little clothing and just a blanket. And there were some others like that. And what was interesting, a takeaway from there, is they had the same wind down. They don't have a television, but everybody has fire. And they would sit in the evening and they would have this wind down. Not when it got dark, they don't go to sleep, but later on when it gets cooler. And it's about 4 or 5 hours after they have their meal. So it's very similar, and it answered a lot of questions about modern sleep patterns.
It occurs to me that these days, with the internet being what it is, there's an awful lot of misinformation about sleep cycles and REM cycles and what is important and how much is important. So quickly, before we go to our calls at 800-348-2551, if you could educate me on the sleep cycles and how much I need to be normal.
Okay. The quick answer is it looks like 7 to 9 hours for most adults. It does matter the age. Babies are sleeping up to 16 hours of every 24. But there are different patterns, and some people actually on a genetic basis sleep better on later hours and sleep later into the morning. And they might be called lazy or they're going to miss work or school.
Yeah.
But there's a genetic basis for that, as well as early bird types. So the amount of sleep is fairly fixed. And the other interesting thing is that it used to be until recently that the normal range was thought to be 6 to 9. But all kinds of studies are showing problems when people get 6 hours of sleep chronically. So 7 to 9 is the new standard.
Society being what it is, what percentage of the population do you think actually gets 7 to 9 hours of sleep?
There's definitely a mismatch, and we're paying for it in terms of things like obesity, because metabolism is affected by sleep, functioning, falling asleep on the job, on the highways, you know, so it is a problem.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Paul Glavinsky is Clinical Director of St. Peter's Sleep Center in Albany, New York. And let's go to the phones. We start with June in Poughkeepsie. June, you're on.
Hi, doctor. My problem is, it seems like even if I get enough sleep, like 7 hours, and I wake up and naturally and I say, wow, I really slept well. I didn't have any interruptions. And I'm not someone to jump out of bed. I work for myself. But what'll happen is I'll just kind of like roll over and want to just think about my day or just give myself some time to get out of bed. And next thing I know, I've fallen in a very, very deep sleep. I could go on for an hour or two, and I just feel like I'm comatose and I can't get out of bed. Mm-hmm. So I was just wondering if that might have anything to do with circadian rhythms.
It could. Do you think you have good sleep from the beginning of the night, or is your best sleep those last couple hours?
I think it's always early morning. Yeah.
Early morning, right.
Those last couple
so
hours.
We've been
yeah.
talking about how some people actually do better on a later schedule. And for people who have their own businesses and have a way to match sleep to their daytime work, it's a reasonable solution to try to judge. But there are lots of other reasons. I'll just quickly name two. The quality of sleep makes a difference. So people can get 7 or 8 hours of sleep. And we'll talk about apnea later, for example, and it can be interrupted many times that they wouldn't know about. And then they wake up after 7 or 8 hours and they still have this residual sleepiness. The last
I am on a CPAP. I should have mentioned that.
Yeah. And then the other thing is that you shouldn't really take gauge your readiness for the day immediately upon awakening, because actually when we sleep well, there's something called sleep inertia. And we can have a good night's sleep.
Oh, yeah, I got a lot of that.
And we actually are kind of groggy and slow, like molasses. But that doesn't mean necessarily that the sleep was poor.
No, I'm saying that like this morning, I woke up and felt refreshed, mm-hmm. but just not jumping out of bed immediately, I ended up falling back asleep and then getting in a very deep sleep. Mm-hmm. So even though I slept 7 hours, felt wore my CPAP, felt like it was a good solid night, there still was this
right.
factor
well, let me
of
give you
a
quick intervention that you can try. So you could log how much sleep you get with the two pieces, the first part and the hour or two end, and make a fraction of how much sleep you get divided by how much time you spend in bed. Okay, those are the two numbers. And, once you calculate what that fraction is, if it's not around 85%. If you're not spending 85% of the time in bed sleeping, you might want to cut down on your bedtime, because that's sort of, I don't know, your particulars, but that's sort of a ballpark.
All right, June, thanks for the call. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Paul Glavinsky is here from St. Peter's Sleep Center. Walk us through, before we take our first break and then get back to the phones, our last caller mentioned the CPAP machine, which is something someone wears at night to help with apnea.
Right.
Walk us through what happens when someone goes to the sleep center for the first time. They're having terrible trouble sleeping. They're falling asleep maybe, in the driveway or at work. What happens at the sleep center?
Okay. So what happens is actually starts before they would see a doctor, because based on some questions that are asked at the time of the phone call, they will be sort of directed. For example, I am dealing with more insomnia and circadian rhythm disorders. I have some wonderful colleagues who deal more with sleep apnea.
Yeah.
And so an appointment will be set up for an initial consultation. There's not a sleep study right away, and some people actually don't have one. But it will start with a consultation with some questionnaires. And there's a pretty involved history because everything connects to sleep, you know?
Yeah.
Every aspect of health, your social situation, stresses at work.
Yeah.
So we have to really get through a lot there. And based on that history, which is all done in the first hour, oftentimes there's a decision either to get some more information, other kinds of tests, maybe some log keeping, or a decision to have either a home sleep test, which we're doing more and more of, or an in-lab test, which is more involved.
Involves staying overnight.
That would be overnight. With the home sleep test, we can pick up the more obvious cases, the more subtle cases, sometimes we have to go to the in-lab test.
I mean, people I know who have gone and stayed overnight, they said, oh my God, I wake up hundreds of times a night.
That's right, because what they're referring to are transient arousals.
Yeah.
And this is what causes people to think that they've been sleeping but be so, you know, miserable, like they've been run over by a truck, they say, because we see on the EEG when we're watching the tracing that over and over again, oftentimes linked to difficulty breathing, the brain is coming out of sleep to a lighter stage of sleep or all the way to wakefulness. And there's usually a little stirring, and the whole thing lasts between 3 and 15 seconds. And it can happen a couple hundred times. And certainly people are not aware of more than a few awakenings a night.
Yeah.
And that's why a lot of people can have sleep apnea for years and not know it until they have a sleep study.
And operate on a 30% quality level for years without knowing how much better it can be.
That's right.
Dr. Paul Glavinsky is our guest. We talk sleep medicine today on a Medical Monday. Our number is 800-348-2551. And we'll be back with more calls coming up. It occurs to me that a great cure for insomnia is listening to one of my programs. It seems to work most of the time. It's a Vox Pop. It's Medical Monday, but not today because it's very exciting. Dr. Paul Glavinsky is here from the St. Peter's Sleep Center in Albany. He is co-author of You Are Getting Sleepy. What's that book about?
That book is about insomnia, and what's different about it is it's the focus on you. There are different chapters that look at different things that people sort of bring to bed, what they sort of contribute to the issue. So one might be, are you too hyper to sleep? One might be, are you too depressed to sleep? Are you too out of sync, where we talk about circadian rhythm disorders? Are you too dependent on sleeping pills?
Yeah.
So that's the basis of that
book.
Very
interesting. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Let's go to Jim in Matamoros, Pennsylvania. Jim, you're on.
How does blue light disrupt sleep patterns as opposed to colored lights of different wavelengths?
How does blue light disrupt sleep patterns?
Yeah, that's a great question. So about 20 years ago, it was discovered that the eye has a different receptor besides the rods and cones that we all learned about in biology.
Yeah.
Those rods and cones go for vision in the back of the brain. These special receptors are just looking for a particular wavelength of blue light. It's a very deep sort of royal blue. And they don't go to the back of the brain. They go to the circadian clock, which is in the hypothalamus. And as long as the eye sees the blue light, which is always in the sunlight, meaning it's daytime, we do not make melatonin in our brain. But as soon as the sun goes down, then those receptors no longer see blue light coming in, and it's a signal for the brain that night is coming on and you should start making melatonin for sleep later on.
Interesting.
But when you look at a screen, for example, like a laptop, the blue light from the screen fools the brain into thinking the sun is still out, even though it might be 10 or 11 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
And that's why you can download for free blue light filters that block the blue pixels on the screen. One is called F.Lux if you have a PC, and then Night Shift is the Apple. And you just do it once, and then it cycles from then on, so it knows what time it is, and it'll block the light for you.
So you think the evolutionary purpose behind this not rod, not cone, this other receptor, was related to making sure that early humans woke up in the daytime and did their thing?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There's some wonderful work. They don't do it in humans, but in animals, field studies with a certain kind of gopher or that kind of animal that did have a circadian clock disorder. And guess what happens to all those gophers? They're all out at the wrong time when the predators have an easy field day. So unless you are timed to the cycles, you're in trouble on an evolutionary basis. So you're absolutely right.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's a Medical Monday. We talk sleep disorders and such with Dr. Paul Glavinsky. And let's go to Steve in Albany. Steve.
Hi, I've got two questions. One is that there are some sleep clinics where the doctors started in pulmonology and others where they started in neurology. And so I wondered if there are advantages one way or the other. And the other question that I had is that I noticed that some people are now suggesting CBP, if I've got the right letters, which comes from what, hemp?
Yes. Okay. CBD. Okay.
And I'm not sure how, if that's sensible to use and how.
Okay. Well, let me go with the first question first. So when I started, actually, it was before it was even a medical specialty. And I'm a psychologist, and it was more of a open field, lots of different people joining it. But over the years, it did coalesce into a specific medical subspecialty, sleep disorders did. And there are, I believe, four different medical specialties that can go on to become subspecialized in sleep: neurology, pulmonology, ear, nose, and throat, and pediatrics. And all of them take exams and get trained so that the basics of sleep are shared by all of these physicians. But it does make sense if you're thinking, for example, that there are suggestions of sleep apnea. A pulmonologist who deals with breathing generally, and a sleep who's also a sleep specialist, you know, would be a good place. There are problems with sleeping, such as excessive daytime sleepiness, narcolepsy, hypersomnias that have to do with the brain not functioning in the proper way. And breathing seems fine, and there's not snoring and so on. So if you can find a neurologist, sleep specialist, it's reasonable, although people do treat across because it's a common discipline.
And then CBD oil was his second question.
Right. So that, you know, certainly is popular the last couple of years, and most of these oils do not have any of the THC ingredient that would cause a high from a drug, but they do seem to cause a mild sedation and just calming. I can only offer anecdotal evidence because about, you know, I would say 20% of my patients now have tried it.
Yeah.
And, you know, some are finding it helpful. I don't know that it's been around long enough for systematic studies.
As a doctor, does it present a moral question for you to prescribe something that really hasn't been, there hasn't been a lot of clinical studies done on it?
Right. And let me say that I'm not a physician and I'm not prescribing anything.
Okay.
So I'm a psychologist. For speaking as a psychologist, here's what I would say, that sleep is very interesting because we tend to give the credit for our sleep to everything except ourselves.
Yeah.
And if you start taking a placebo or CBD or a little chamomile tea or anything and you have a good night's sleep, you will credit that tea or that oil rather than yourself.
Yeah.
And that is, to my mind, a step in the wrong direction. I'm all about showing people that they can take control and do things on their own and not look for an external influence. Not that sometimes we don't use them.
A crutch can be helpful.
But that's my take on it.
What about melatonin?
Yeah. So melatonin is, because it's a hormone that is actually very directly related to our ability to sleep, it definitely has a place. It's been around for many, many years, and people have been taking it because it's not a prescription. It's from a health food store or whatever.
You can get them in the grocery store.
Right. It certainly has its place. I would say the take home on melatonin is almost everybody that I work with takes too much. The brain secretes melatonin, as we talked about, when the sun goes down, in tenths of a milligram. And the stores didn't know this, and the companies didn't know this when they started making it. So their doses are 10, 20, 50, 100 times more than what's needed.
Is that dangerous?
It is a psycho and biologically active substance. It's the only hormone that you would ever hear a doctor say, here, take this forever. I don't have to hear about it anymore. You would never do that with thyroid or with estrogen or with anything else. So there is kind of a reconsideration that, hey, what have we let out here with the melatonin? I should say it has a very interesting, specific use. Unlike any other sleep aid, it's the one substance that can change the timing of the clock that we talked about.
Ah.
And that's what, you know, I do in terms of circadian rhythm. We can manipulate light and melatonin, because they're linked in the way we talked about, to shift the clock so that somebody who has a hard time falling asleep, you know, until, say, 3 in the morning, we could try to get them to sleep earlier.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Paul Glavinsky is our guest. We talk sleep today. And Ruth Ann in Albany is next. Ruth Ann.
Hello?
Hello. You're on.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, Dr. Glavinsky. Thank you.
Yes.
I do wear a sleep pet machine, and I would like to ask you, I know a lot of people wear them, and it is the cure-all, but it's taken a long time to figure out how to get it to work to some degree. My concern is that, I guess I'm asking, what do you know about how effective they are with these auto paps and auto things on them? Like, I wake up, I'm only getting, say, 4 hours now on the machine, because the if you turn on your back, the thing blows all this air at you, and then it wakes you up, and you can't, you know, you don't want to go back to sleep because your mouth is dry, et cetera. And I'm a proponent, I believe in it, but I also wondered, you know, how much do you trust this machine? They're saying we're going to help our heart disease, but now I have heart disease too. So I'm wondering if the machines that are automatically are actually really working, because I do have some doubts, so I wonder if you could address that.
Sure. Thank you. Let me just also ask you, have you been back to your doctor who prescribed this, and are you being followed in some sort of systematic way? Because that's very important. You're bringing up a lot of...
It's tricky. I mean, they see you, but they say, oh, it all looks good on the chart. But, you know, they don't live it. They don't necessarily live the mission experience. So, you know, it all looks good, and the data looks good. You're not leaking, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
But
right. Okay.
So it's blowing so much air at you that you can't.
Sure. So let me start by saying.
All right. Let him answer.
That if the machine is working well, it is the gold standard. All the other things that we do, we measure against CPAP, because you can, what we call titrate CPAP. You can adjust it in terms of pressure and the volume and the pacing and how it's delivering, and you can generally get rid of the way we call get rid of, meaning that we get it down to a number that's close to 0 per hour. Under 5 an hour is the official definition if you have apneic or hypopneic disturbance under 5 an hour. So in the best case, yes, it works. But you're absolutely right that a lot of people have problems tolerating it for lots of reasons, from the dry mouth to the noise to being connected with the hose to, you know, on and on and on, the mask fit and so on. And that's why it's so important to, you know, work with somebody who is going to take the time to ferret out what the problems are that are keeping you from having a better response, because it can be done. And, you know, I think the first thing is to go back to your doctor and just say, you know, here's what I'm doing. Here's where I'm thinking it's going wrong for me. There are many different kinds of units, masks, and pressures, and so on. So you probably can do better.
Ruth Ann, thank you for the call. Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's Medical Monday, sleep and sleep disorders today with Dr. Paul Glavinsky. And we go to Rick in Stockbridge. Rick, you're on.
Hey, good afternoon, guys. Hey, Ray, you're right. I almost fell asleep.
You see, that's how I do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it felt great. Yeah, I'm kind of an enigma. I'll just tell you a quick backstory. In 1998, I was one of 7 people who caught this Australian strain of the flu. And of the seven people, I'm the only one who survived it. And nobody knows why I survived it. I ended up, in 27 hours, I lost somewhere between 35 and 40 pounds of water.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up losing half my heart, a stroke, but brain damage too. And for 12 years after that, I used to tell my doctor I'm exhausted. And he finally sent me to a sleep therapist, and they found out I woke up on average 62 times every hour. And they had no idea why. And they put me on sleep medicines. None of them worked. I finally took trazodone for the last, 8 years or whatever it's been. And now it's kind of wearing off, and I'm exhausted all the time. And I'm wondering if there's any possibility anybody would know what's going on with my brain, why it won't let me sleep.
Yeah. Well, actually, there are reports of what's termed hypersomnia, which is being too sleepy. And the sort of grab bag is idiopathic hypersomnia, meaning we don't know why.
Mm.
But over the years, there are definitely cases that have been described of people who have either encephalitis or other problems that cause a brain trauma of some sort, or even a fall off of a ladder, that lead to hypersomnia. So it's an acquired hypersomnia. Flu is one of them. You would do well with a neurologist sleep disorder specialist. Can I give a referral here?
You can't say go to this person.
Okay, okay. But in general, you should go to a big city. Boston and New York have a couple neurology sleep disorder specialists, because this is a very complicated case.
Yeah.
And that's where you would probably find somebody who's familiar with this literature.
Yeah, I did go to one back in 2010, and they didn't have a clue. They had no idea what was going on. I mean, what happens when you lose 40 pounds of water,
And yeah, I mean, I can't get into specifics, but there are people who are studying this post-traumatic hypersomnia. That's the sort of the overall term for it.
Rick, thanks for the call and good luck. Our number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Paul Glavinsky is our guest, and let's go now to John in South Colony. John.
Hi, doctor. I wanted to ask you about sleep aids, whether they be prescription or non-prescription. My story is, a number of years ago, I was prescribed Xanax for anxiety. And after using it for a very short while, I realized I didn't really like it. And I stayed away from it. But I eventually found out that if I take a dose before I go to bed, I get what I would call the most perfect night of sleep I'm going to get at this point in my life. So what I do is I take it twice a week. I don't want to take it every night. I know it builds up in the body and it takes a couple days to clear. So those two nights a week I look forward to, because I know I'm going to have a great night's sleep. Otherwise, it's real hit or miss. I don't know what I'm going to get as far as sleep. Based on what you said earlier, I'd like to take credit for that, but I really think this medication has a lot to do with it. So my question to you is, do you have any recommendations for something that doesn't build up a tolerance in the body? I'm thinking possibly medical marijuana, some other substitute that would be uninvasive, for lack of a better term.
I guess the short answer is no. They all have the effect of generally doing well when you take them sporadically, which you are doing. I mean, twice a week, certainly not seven times a week. This is something that, between you and your prescribing doctor, if your doctor is okay and you can function well and you use it twice, and you're absolutely right, you retain sensitivity by only using it a few times a week. It can be a reasonable strategy. I don't prescribe, so I work behaviorally. I would like to say something about over-the-counter.
Sure.
Because that's part of the question that's interesting. So a lot of people use these things. This is like Benadryl-type drugs, antihistamines, things that have like Tylenol PM.
Mm-hmm.
And what many people are not aware of is that there's pretty good data of the last couple of years from very large-scale studies that are showing that the kinds of anticholinergic drugs like Benadryl that make your mouth dry, that's a good tip off, are associated with memory problems down the road. And it's really what we call a dose response. The more you take over, you know, a lifetime, the more risk there is for memory issues. So you have to be careful. That was published in JAMA. I mean, you can look it up.
And sure. All right, John, thank you for the call. Paul Glavinsky is our guest today, Clinical Director of St. Peter's Sleep Center in Albany. Our number is 800-348-2551. And Justin in Saratoga Lake is on. Justin.
Hi.
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 So my question is, I tend to drink a lot of water before bed and then have to wake up usually every 2 or 3 hours to use the restroom. Now, when I don't drink enough water, I feel very dehydrated in the morning, and I always wake up with a pretty severe headache or like a migraine. So can you recommend anything to help me have a more full night's sleep while still staying hydrated for the morning?
Mm-hmm. How old are you, Justin?
I am 30.
Mm-hmm. So for 30-year-old waking up once in the night is sort of normal range, but it sounds like, are you waking 3 times or 2 times on average?
It's usually 2 or 3, yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, so it's a little more than we expect. You know, we have a hormone, it's called the antidiuretic hormone, that's supposed to keep us sleeping even when we... But, you know, I think without, again, being a physician here, it's going to be a balancing act for you of you know, trying to titrate down. It's not all or nothing at all. And realizing that getting up once is sort of going to be in the cards. And as you get older, more and more in the cards. So try to get it down to that.
So a little less water maybe before bed?
Yeah, I mean, I would say you certainly, you know, if you're hydrating throughout the rest of the day and then you taper it. And again, that's where sleep logging is very helpful, because you could keep a chart. Nothing makes a difference in one night or even in 1 week with sleep. You really need weeks, not months, not years, weeks, just to do something systematically for weeks and then take a look.
Justin, thanks for the call. We'll take a quick break here. The number is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. It's Medical Monday. Dr. Paul Glavinsky is here. More of your calls coming up. Vox Pop, Medical Monday, Ray Graff in for Alan Shartok today. Dr. Paul Glavinsky is our guest. Dr. Paul Glavinsky is director, clinical director of St. Peter's Sleep Center in Albany, New York. 3 or 4 emails here, Doc, and then we'll get back to the phones for the home stretch. This one's from James. And James writes, I have both central and obstructive apnea. I gave up the CPAP machine because it didn't work for me. I now use an inclined pillow, and it seems to help the obstructive apnea, but I'm not sure it helps with central apnea. Any comments? And since oxygen deprivation is caused by apnea, would breathing extra oxygen at night help?
Okay. Again, we're straying medically. So let's explain a little bit what the difference is. So obstructive apnea means the throat is closing.
Yeah.
The throat doesn't have, the airway is not wide enough, either on a skeletal basis. Some people have jaw structure that there's just not a lot of space.
Yeah.
Or soft tissue like tonsils, adenoids, soft palate, and so on. But people are making an effort to breathe and they just can't. Central apnea means that the effort to breathe is diminished or absent. So
completely different, right?
Right. So the airway can be open, but there's just not the effort. And it can be associated with various medical issues, neurologic issues, cardiac issues. So hopefully, you know, this is something your doctor's on,
okay,
on the case. Basically, the answer is there are different kinds of treatments related to CPAP that often do better with these mixed apneas. So without getting into the specifics, if standard CPAP didn't work, I think certainly there are other things to try before just going with an incline, because people are not a good judge of whether they've treated themselves.
Okay. This one is from Shane in New Paltz. Mm-hmm. My wife is pregnant and now in the end of the first trimester. She's finding that her sleep cycle is now very different. She's awake early in the morning, 4:30 to 5:30 a.m., needing a nap in the afternoon, and tired much earlier in the evening. Is there a way to correct the sleep cycle during pregnancy, or is it an unfortunate side effect that she'll need to wait out?
Right. So there's just a surge of hormones that really affects sleep with pregnancy, and I think that's what's going on here. And of course, there's great reluctance to intervene in anything medically with a pregnant woman.
Yeah.
So, you know, with conditions like this, I mean, my advice is always to go with it, whether it's a pregnancy, whether it's an illness. You have to deal with the condition, especially if it's you know, time limited this way. And I know that's not a very satisfying answer, but we wouldn't want to start altering circadian rhythms on this.
No. The best thing you can do is be very supportive of your wife.
And you know, a nap is fine.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. This one is from Kim. And Kim writes, my client has Parkinson's disease. He sleeps terribly. Why is that? And how can I help him? No Ambien, too many side effects. I'm afraid to give melatonin, maybe that I don't know about. A more natural would be best. And that's from Kim.
Right. So with dementia of different types, we often get reduced sensitivity to cues. Social cues. When you think about what keeps us all in line, we you know, we're going to work, we're having meals at certain time, people are calling a certain time, then it gets quiet. The more someone has an issue with dementia, the less of a difference there is between night and day. And that's often what happens, is sleep starts to be like a cat. It's opportunistic. There's little pieces of sleep that float across the 24 hours.
Yeah.
So for both Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, what's very useful is to really accentuate the day and the night. And there have been studies, for example, that a lot of these patients hardly get any light exposure. They're hardly ever outside. Or we use bright light treatment, if as long as the eyes can handle it, and that has to be looked at.
Yeah.
To, again, differentiating night and day with all kinds of social engagement, light, activity.
Yes.
That then stops for a set period. Oftentimes with a nap built in for these people, so it's not a, you know, a whole day, but there's still some structure. That's what you're trying to do.
Interesting. This one is from Stephen in Pine Bush, and then we'll get back to the phones. Stephen writes, when I was a student, they only talked about narcolepsy as though there was only one type. Now doctors say my wife has type 2 narcolepsy. Can you tell me what the different types of narcolepsy are? And that's from Stephen in Pine Bush.
Right. So narcolepsy is really fascinating, again, for the general listener. So this is an extreme sleepiness that is characterized by very specific symptoms. And the one that's most unusual is that with emotion, like surprise or laughter, people lose this strength in their muscles and they cannot collapse like a rag doll. And that's called cataplexy. And type 1 narcolepsy is sort of the classic narcolepsy with cataplexy. But it's been seen now that oftentimes relatives and others who are not related to a type 1 narcoleptic may have part of the syndrome, and that would be the type 2. So it's the presence or absence of this specific symptom called cataplexy.
All right, let's jump back to the phones now. And Siska, who is in the car, has been up and down off the phone lines here. Are you with us?
I am.
Okay,
yes.
You're on.
Hi, doctor. I think you may have just answered my question when you were talking about the Parkinson's. My husband has Alzheimer's, and so he has a lot of up and down during the night, and trying to figure out the best way to help him. I understand what you're saying about making light and night and dark as distinguishable as possible, but do you recommend any medications or anything like that to help a person in that situation to sleep? Because, you know, obviously he doesn't sleep, I don't sleep.
Yeah.
Right. It's just, you know, it's very tricky, and it's something that you have to talk to your doctor about. Let me talk a little bit about some of the issues are that you have confusion as a given, right? And then when you take confusion and you add sedation from a drug, you can get a lot of bizarre behaviors. So you have to really approach it with caution. I think really structuring the day, and especially, you know, the evening. You know about the sundowning where there's more increased confusion.
Yeah, we definitely, anxiety hits big time with sundowning.
And so there has been some work with light boxes where Alzheimer's patients seem to respond to light boxes that prolong the light inside as if it's like a June evening like we're having now where the sun doesn't go down till you know, close to 9 o'clock out there. So that's something that, you know, can be tried. Again, you have to clear it. There are eye conditions. Not everybody can use it, but that's one promising area of research.
Where do you find something like that?
Well, the light boxes are available.
A light box.
You know, on Amazon, you have to have a careful UV filter. Mm. And again, you need to clear it with the doctor because, again, it's not something – it has UV even when they have the filter.
Okay.
But it can be found.
All right, Siska, thanks for the call. We appreciate your persistence in getting through. Our number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Paul Glavinsky is our guest. Chad is in High Falls. Chad.
Good afternoon, Doctor. Thank you for everything that you do. Obviously, sleeplessness is a huge issue. I want to talk just a bit about meditation. And it is the case, I believe, that one thing that keeps people up at night is their minds are just twirling about, did they do everything they needed to do? What do they have to do tomorrow? Their minds are simply raging,
right,
as it were.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a sound made with the human voice that stops your mind from thinking completely long enough so that if you're tired, you go to sleep. It's available as an app called MetaSounds in the App Store. And I'm wondering, it doesn't sound to me like this is an aberration. I think many of us experience these, you know, sort of thoughts,
right,
which can be helpful in some sense. But MetaSounds in the App Store actually stops your mind from thinking, just listening to these sounds made with the human voice. I don't think that's an aberration in terms of.
Right. Do you have a question?
Things that. Well, I wanted to know whether or not the testing that you do would capture the activity of the mind,
right?
And whether or not it actually is abating or not.
Okay, that's
fair
a good
enough.
Question.
Yeah.
Let me answer one part of that. Actually, the people who come in for the sleep tests usually have a physical problem.
Right.
But you're absolutely right that a racing mind can cause somebody to have insomnia. That person would see someone like me and probably would not undergo a sleep test. I only send maybe one out of 10 people who come to see me, the ones that I think may have something else going on. And anything that can stop that mind racing could be an app, it could be a breathing exercise, it could be formal meditation, it could be muscle relaxation. So anything that produces a calm for about 15 minutes, that's what we need
to fall asleep.
If you can kind of get in the right place for 15 minutes,
all right,
that'll do it.
Thanks for that call, Chad. We appreciate it. Tom in Northville. Tom, you're on.
Hi, thanks. A little bit of background. I'm 42 now. I started having sleep issues when I was 16. So from when I was like 16 to 24, I saw a sleep specialist, a neurologist down in New York City in Boston. Went through the day sleep studies, the weekend, the week-long, the heart monitors, the brain monitors, all of that. They tried various medications. The only one that worked for a little while was Ambien, but the side effects were too crazy. Back then, I got about 3 hours of sleep a night, and that happened from when I was 16 to about 36. Now I'm up to maybe 5 hours of sleep a night. No fatigue, no health issues, no nothing from then or till now. Just curious as to what or if any are long-term effects of sleep disorders.
Right. Well, you've obviously had a big workup and it's a complicated case, but I would say this, that earlier, this might have been off air, I was mentioning that the normal range for adults and sleep need is thought
seven
to be
to nine.
Seven to
yeah.
nine, right. And that was a change from six to nine because there's research of especially the last 5 years or so that is really showing lots of problems for most people when they get six or under. There was some great studies that mimicked what most people get, which is five to six for five nights and then 8 hours for two nights of the week. And even those people also had some medical issues forming.
What?
Like what? Like bone density, like cardiac function, like insulin resistance.
So minor things.
Right. So basically most people need sleep. However, It is a bell curve, and there are people reported in the literature, many fewer than would claim, who do well with a lot less sleep. Very, very rare. But they do exist.
Right.
And if you are not sleepy and can function and you're doing well with 5 hours of sleep, you're probably on that continuum. And, you know, there are not enough of you to really know what the effects of that are. You know,
okay.
You know what I'm saying? You can't do a study on people like you. It's hard to find people like you. But it sounds like you are a short sleeper by nature, a naturally short sleeper, and probably
yes.
doing well.
All right. Well, Tom, thank you very much for that one. Very interesting. And now we go to Lou in Altamont. Lou.
Yes. I know a person that has what I would call sleep-induced, food-induced narcolepsy. They eat. If they remain seated, sit down to watch TV, go to the movies, they fall asleep. Mm-hmm. If they stay awake after a meal during that first hour or two, they have what they describe as brain fog. Any suggestions?
Yeah. Well, one thing I just mentioned is that narcolepsy is used often interchangeably with sleepiness. So people who do eat a big meal, that's known, and some of the ingredients, like the tryptophan, for
sure.
example, can cause in cheese or turkey or so
meal,
on.
Sir, not a big meal.
Not a big meal.
Okay. But it's probably not narcolepsy. So we're talking about sleepiness after a meal. And it's, you know, a change from in terms of digestion that produces processes that you're trying to relax. Usually people do not sleep well for a night, but people do get sleepy. You know, I don't really have a specific suggestion. It's a very common issue.
Hmm. All right, Lou, thanks so much. Now we go to Len in Clifton Park. Len.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'm at the same problem everybody. 68 years old, and for the past 3 or 4 years, you know, I got to wake up at 3 o'clock to go to the toilet. And of course, I absolutely don't drink anything after supper to minimize that problem, but then I have a problem to get back to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm supposed to be taking aspirin for blood thinning, so I could do that at 3 o'clock or take a glass of wine, or what do you suggest?
Are you sleepy in the evening?
Yeah, well, yeah, I guess most people age really get sleepy around 9:30. No problem at all getting to sleep and sleep until about 3 o'clock.
Right. Well, so you have what we call an advanced sleep phase, and you said you were 68 years old. Is that what I heard?
Yeah. My father had the same thing.
Right.
He'd go
to
bed at 9,
as we get older, this biological clock that I've been talking about, it runs slow in adolescents, and they like to be up late and sleep late, not just because of socialize,
right.
but it also runs fast as we get older, and
yeah.
that's what's happening. There are treatments. There are treatments, again, and it involves melatonin and light, but you're kind of going against the flow of your clock, which is running fast, and that's why. So to the extent that you can forestall the sleepiness in the evening and get the light, try this in June, since we have light till 9 o'clock. Take a walk
okay.
for 45 minutes before sunset to sunset, or just be out in that light.
Heavy exercise helps, you know, like I go skiing for the day.
Right, but I'm talking about the light, the last light of the day would be helpful for you.
Okay.
Well, Len, I guess we'll have to leave it.
Twilight.
All right, we'll have to leave it there, I'm afraid. Well, Dr. Paul Glavinsky, how do people find out more about St. Peter's Sleep Center?
Can I give the number?
Sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So, we're located on Washington Avenue Extension, 518-464-9999.
Well,
so easy to remember.
Thank you. It was very instructive having you on the program. Support comes from New York Oncology Hematology. Offices in Albany, Amsterdam, Clifton Park, Hudson, on Troy, with a team of 35 physicians, world-class cancer care close to home, NewYorkOncology.com. Once again, thanks to Dr. Paul Glavinsky for being here. Thank you for listening. Tremendous calls, great emails. Thank you all. Thanks to Zach Malloy. The veins only popped out in his head once during the program when there was some background noise. You're getting very calm. Serenity now. Good job there, Zach. Thanks to Joe Makowitz, who answered the calls today. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Have a great rest of your Monday. We'll see you tomorrow at 2. Stay tuned now for the Media Project.